Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
Everybody, welcome to ANCAST. I'm Zach Birchie. Justin's here.
Howdy.
And our very special guest this week is the former marketing manager for Bandai Entertainment USA. Currently, he is the publishing and multimedia manager at Blizzard. It's Jerry Chu. Jerry, thank you very much for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me.
So, Jerry, you actually got started and kind of got hired at Bandai because you were a super fan. Is that true?
That's a kind of a loaded question. I was actually, I was in college at the time at UC Irvine, and I was the president of the anime club down there. And, really it was a kind of a social club for me. Certainly I was a big, anime fan, but, on top of all of that, I was actually I was kind of a shopkeeper as well. And, you know, I was bringing in a lot of merchandise and selling it. And Bandai kind of, they found me through the UC Irvine kind of network and found the anime club and contacted myself and another individual to see if we wanted to come in as an intern. And so I did that for about, 3 months and ended up getting hired on full time.
Cool. So this was like the very, very nascent phase of Bandai's U.S. presence as an anime publisher.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was back in, early 1998. And Bandai Entertainment, in its form, was probably in existence a year or two before that.
So you were you there for the launch of AnimeVillage.com?
I was part of the launch for AnimeVillage.com. That was actually the brainchild between Marlon Shulman, a former Orion executive, and Kenny Adomi. And Marlon had come from Orion and had pitched an idea to create an anime online destination. And keep in mind, this was during the big internet bubble time period. But his vision was really to have a site where a destination for fans could go and, you know, share their love and interest for Japanese animation. And at the same time, we'd be able to bring direct to consumer a lot of the different anime titles that were in Japan, directly.
Now, at this point, you guys were known for having a little bit of a rocky launch. Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like in those, the first couple of days and how it was like to just kind of start from scratch there?
Well, I think part of it is, understanding the business and really understanding the consumer and the market. I mean, during that time period in the late 90s, you had a lot of small companies at the time, really at this point, getting some of this content, to a wider audience, but it was still kind of relegated to Suncoast. It was still very, very niche. And from our side, Ken had, really a long experience from his LA Hero days. So he kind of understood a lot of that. But the idea that Marlon was putting together for Anime Village was a bit different. And I think a lot of the rockiness you alluded to, really had to deal with the website itself and the way the content was, packaged and delivered to consumers. There was a lot of different kind of supply chain issues as well as technical issues that needed to be ironed out. And we were at the time doing a lot of it, on the fly.
Were you trying to do it all in-house?
We did it all in-house. I mean, the actual replication and duplication of the at that time VHS tapes were done by a third party. We had been working with another web design firm as well on the site itself. So it was a lot of, you know, third-party folks kind of putting this all together. And, you know, really our big launch had happened back in Comic-Con, where we actually brought the big Gundam F-91 head and kind of made our first appearance, you know, to the public.
Cool. I remember hearing about that. I didn't get to go that year. But so the first launch titles, if I remember correctly, were Saber Marionette J, of all things, which, you know, was a decent title for its day. The Vision of Escaflowne, which obviously is a classic, and Clamp School Detectives.
My favorite.
Yours and mine. How did that work? Was it just what you could get easily at the time, or how were those that initial lineup chosen?
You know what? I can't really speak to that since I wasn't part of that original discussion. You know, I think a lot of it had to do with our relationship with Bandai Visual and Sunrise at the time. Obviously, we knew that Gundam, you know, had to be, you know, kind of part of that mix. But we also wanted kind of a variety of different, you know, programming as well. And Clamp was certainly, even at that time, a known name within the business. So, you know, that was certainly one that kind of rounded out our portfolio and diversified it. You know, I think from my point, you know, where we really came into play as far as selecting titles, you know, didn't really come until the Cowboy Bebop time period, and really seeing, you know, kind of what else was happening in Japan, and really lobbying for it, you know, internally. Outlaw Star was a great example of that. At the time, I remember a lot of folks just kind of wondering, is this show any good? Is it generic? And you know, I myself and a few other folks, you know, really fought for it and lobbied Ken to kind of bring this over. And, you know, it's done pretty well.
Yeah, that was probably your second biggest hit to Bebop, wasn't it?
From a sales perspective?
Yeah.
No, oh. It wasn't. You know, I think our biggest seller, and I'm pretty sure it still holds true right now, is Cowboy Bebop. And that continues to do well based on, you know, what I've heard. But, you know, at the time, you know, while I was at Bandai, I mean, it was kind of head and shoulders above anything else. You know, I think I left around 2005, and really, you know, both Ghost in the Shell, you know, had really gotten up there in terms of sales. And then I would think Gundam Wing was right behind there, and Escaflowne was probably the next largest. But Outlaw Stars certainly did very well for Bandai.
Okay. Well,
if so, it sounds like from the very beginning, this was all launched as a mean, like Gundam is what we're trying to sell, and then, oh, we also have this other stuff. But Gundam was the chief franchise that y'all were basically told to push. Is that accurate? It sounds like maybe it was.
I wouldn't say it was what we were told, you know, it was pushed upon us to do Gundam. You know, I think at the time and you know, the fan community for Gundam had been clamoring for Bandai to bring, you know, that content out, you know, for years and years and years. And I'm sure, you know, other industry folks, you know, can recount stories of how they've approached Sunrise to bring that, you know, in the past as well. But I think a lot of this was a perfect storm, that this was a Bandai subsidiary. Bandai Entertainment is a subsidiary of Bandai America. And this was a Bandai-related company, and this was really Sunrise's first opportunity to do something that was kind of official. And so because of all the clamoring in the past and just the stature of Gundam as an animated franchise, it just kind of made a lot of sense. Now, at the time, I think we launched with the abbreviated Gundam movies, 1, 2, and 3. We had Worn the Pocket. We also had Double 83. So we were really trying to focus on that kind of universal century and setting that foundation, you know, for the franchise right out the gate.
Were they successful early on?
I mean, they did well. You know, I think for a lot of whether or not it was successful, it's kind of tough to say, because, right, you know, Anime Village for all intents and purposes lasted about a year and a half. I think the sales direct to consumer, you know, we were in many ways kind of a bit ahead of our time and in a weird place because we were in a transition period from VHS tapes to DVD. Yeah. And the tapes themselves, I think, you know, they were okay. But in order to really generate the type of unit sales that we were looking for, we had to, you know, go back and adopt a more traditional brick and mortar business model. And that's really what we focused on, you know, under Bandai Entertainment and that transition between Anime Village to really what you're seeing right now.
So where did you fit into all of this, like starting from Anime Village and then after the transition?
I was a peon. My responsibility was the guy, was the gopher to do things and get things done. You know, I worked for pretty much, everyone, in there from, Mr. Matsuki, who, you know, really focused on the tech, side of, you know, Anime Village and the website, on down to Mr. Yodomi and Marlon Shulman. When we transitioned over to Bandai Entertainment, you know, Marlon, had departed from Bandai, and I was working for Nobu Yamamoto, who was brought in from another Bandai group company to kind of head up marketing. And so between Nobu and I, we really kind of, you know, kick-started what that marketing department looked like then to now. Nobu eventually moved on to Genion and bounced around. And then from my side, I kind of took over the overall marketing, I think around, 99, 2000. And then, from there, kind of just did my thing.
The, that transition is an odd period because you guys released, a second wave of really kind of marginal titles that didn't catch fire and then followed almost immediately with Cowboy Bebop.
Which titles are you referring to specifically?
Urguys, Eat Man, Don't Leave Me Alone, Daisy.
those were interesting titles.
That's my word for them.
I think a lot of it had to do with you know, creating a more diversified portfolio of animation offerings. You know, we were so focused on Bandai Visual and Sunrise that we did have a relationship also with I think it was D-Rights at the time and Mitsubishi, and a lot of those titles, you know, came from that relationship. Most of them didn't do that great, but you know, there were a lot of gems in there that I think people really appreciated, Honda Junction specifically.
And I actually am a big Eat Man fan, not of 98, but regular Eat Man.
Okay.
I appear to be alone in this.
I was just about
certainly,
to...
Certainly I'm not part of that.
I was just about to make fun of Haunted Junction, but I guess that's a hidden gem.
Haunted Junction was one of those titles that really encapsulated everything about anime at that time. It was a fun show. It had a little bit of the sexiness at the same time. It was just, you know, it's kind of what I expected from you know, a 13-episode series at the time. It wasn't the best animated show. It wasn't the best story, but it kept me entertained the entire way. I can't say that for a lot of shows these days.
What was it like in the office at that time? Because I remember when I got to CPM, it was mostly like, I guess you would consider them American, you know, just there for the money type people. And I always imagined Bandai being mostly run by Japanese people who didn't really know American fans and didn't really interact with them on a daily basis.
It was certainly run extremely Japanese. You know, Kenny Yodomi is Japanese.
Really?
But at the same time, yeah, I know. At the same time, though, he's lived in the U.S. for a long time. You know, again, his experience at L.A. Hero, you know, really translated well to him leading, you know, this division. I think a lot of the folks that worked internally at BEI at that time, you know, we really made a conscious effort to make sure that the fans were kept in mind first and foremost. I think, you know, in everything we did, whether it was that transition to DVD and looking at new formats, to taking a look at, you know, different titles, you know, issues, complaints. I mean, we saw it all. You know, one of the reasons why we went to as many conventions, you know, as we did, it was a great way to, you know, extend our voice, and have the fans extend their voice to us, and to kind of hear, you know, what they've been looking for or what they needed, you know, out of a publisher like Bandai. And so I think it was a great time. And each one of the folks that I worked with, you know, many of them were fans themselves. So while it was a very Japanese company, you know, I think we really enjoyed taking pride in knowing that the fans really did come first and doing our best to cater to them.
The, who was the first one to say we need to get this stuff on TV?
I have to give credit to that to Mr. Iodomi and Miss Davis, Rika Davis. You know, between the two of them, you know, they really, you know, worked with the programmers over at Cartoon Network. I think at the time it was Terry Kalangian and Mike Lazo, you know, on things like Toonami, that block of programming, and later on with Adult Swim. And I think, you know, at least from my perspective, you know, BEI really hung its hat on, we're going to be doing DVDs and releases for the fans, but at the same time, we really want to broaden the market and really bring this to a larger audience, take it from the niche to a larger audience. And broadcast was really the only way to do that. And, you know, I credit Mr. Iodomi in really opening up those channels and establishing, you know, kind of that modern beachhead for Japanese animation content.
The well, obviously everyone knows the ton of shows that you guys had on Toonami. People have kind of forgotten how many shows, though. I mean, you guys threw everything on there. Was that always a case of Cartoon Network wanting to take it, or was that kind of more of a, well, the rumor I'm trying to get to here is that some of it was kind of, you know, given to Cartoon Network for free, or actually sold or almost bought ad time from Cartoon Network.
I mean, I think there was certainly, you know, some of that. You know, Ghost in the Shell, I mean, that was something that Cartoon Network, you know, really, really, really wanted. And, you know, from our side, I think what you alluded to as far as, you know, ad swapping and media, you know, I think that certainly was part of that conversation. You know, we wanted to make sure that, you know, Cartoon Network, you know, was really promoting, you know, that show. And so it was part of that agreement. You know, as far as, you know, how many content we put on there or whether or not, you know, broadcasters paid or did not pay, you know, we worked with a lot of different, you know, broadcasters. I mean, Fox was one of them, Cartoon Network, Sci-Fi, so on. So, you know, from certainly some of them, you know, paid, others were kind of, co-financed. And other one was really, hey, we have some content and, we want to work with you in getting this content on air, and hopefully, you know, you'll find that value, and bring some eyeballs to your channel.
So there is truth to the fact, there's truth to the old story that Bandai was effectively paying to have their shows run on Cartoon Network.
I wouldn't say Cartoon Network. I mean, I think I mentioned a bunch of different broadcasters. Cartoon Network certainly, you know, did what they needed to do to get the programming, you know, including ponying up some money.
Right. Okay. Hmm.
The I'd love to hear a little bit about the whole Escaflowne on Fox saga. What was that like? What happened there?
You know, I think the decision for Escaflowne on Fox, and I'm assuming you're talking about the edits, you know, on that show. A lot of it was really, you know, how do we bring this to a larger audience? And Fox at that time, and this was predating, you know, kind of 4Kids and what ultimately ended up happening into that block of programming. But we worked with Fox to really try and get this show prime time and get it in front of as many people as possible. You know, I don't think anyone really expected the amount of edits and whatnot that ultimately occurred. But, you know, that's kind of water under the bridge at this point. But well, I think it did bring a lot of people, you know, to Escaflowne. I think a lot of people that wouldn't have seen it, you know, otherwise, you know, got their exposure from Fox. So, it, you know, at the end of the day, it brought some new fans to anime in general.
So with did you basically just I don't really understand how this works. Do you guys, when you sell something to Fox, do you just basically give them the masters and say have at it? Or
I wouldn't say it's necessarily, you know, here's the masters, have at it. You know, I'm
obviously oversimplifying.
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, content and programming that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, while we wouldn't want any editing or censorship, you know, they have, you know, separate departments whose sole responsibility is to make sure the content is, you know, quote unquote appropriate for their block or for their programming time. And so a lot of the edits that occur, you know, will be made aware of. We may not be able to say yes or no, but it's something that's kind of part of the process in getting programming, you know, on television. You know, I'll always cite things like in Gundam Wing, where if there's a cigarette, it suddenly, or is after now, I forget if it was Gundam Wing or Cowboy Bebop, where a cigarette, you know, mysteriously turns into a toothpick and things like that, or blood turns into, you know, kind of a bluish sweat. But these were kind of the small little edits that were done in order to pass whatever departmental board there were to get the show on television.
Was Japan generally understanding about the edits, or were there meetings?
I was not privy to that, so I don't know.
Okay, had to ask.
Well, I gotta ask about that because you know, the edits to, you know, that Escaflowne thing. It's obviously, this is more than 10 years ago at this point, I think, or close to it. How long did you get punished by the fans for that? Like, how many questions did you have to take? Like, how many years after it were you still getting questions about the goddamn Escaflowne Fox Kids dub, which, frankly, was on the air for what? Like, 5 episodes or something? It didn't run very long.
Yeah, I mean, at least from my own perspective, I didn't get a lot. It wasn't a ton of. I think there was a lot of flack around that time period. But I think those that really enjoyed Escaflowne, and even those that watched the show on Fox, we had the unedited versions available, and I think everyone just kind of appreciated that. And that's something that, you know, again, you know, Bandai really hung its hat on. You know, we have these TV versions that were made available, but we also have that uncut, unedited one as well. Again, keeping in mind that the fans, you know, at the time really wanted, you know, as close to the original source material as possible, and we made all of it available. So the backlash and that sort of thing, you know, I didn't really see it from my side, maybe for the first few months. But at the end of the day, you know, if you really enjoyed Escaflowne, I mean, we had a product that was right for you.
Turning back to the big franchise, to Gundam, you guys, Gundam has had a very spotty reception in the U.S., I've noticed. What were some of the things you guys tried that worked? What didn't work?
Well, I think Gundam Wing worked, and, you know, and that was a very strategic and planned approach. You know, for Gundam, you know, back in 99, once we were able to kind of solidify that Toonami block and bring, you know, Gundam Wing out there. At the time, it was the most popular Gundam series and the most recent. I think in Japan, it launched in 94, 95, and, you know, certainly had its fan base. And it was a perfect storm as well. So we had the broadcast, we had the show, as far as home video was concerned. But we also had Bandai America. And, you know, this was a time period where the toy side of the business said, hey, maybe this is a time, you know, we have the broadcast, this is the time to bring the model kits and that sort of thing out there. And, you know, I got to hand it to Bandai America. They really pulled out, you know, all the stops to get these, you know, what they kind of rebranded as action figure model kits and get it out on store shelves. So that was really the perfect storm as far as, you know, getting Gundam and introducing that to the Western audience. Now, what happened after that is really the, at least in my opinion, you know, where Gundam faltered. And, you know, I have to say a lot of that, you know, rests with the decisions made in Japan and not in the U.S.
Was one of those decisions, we need to air the original Gundam 0079 on television?
That's exactly it. I mean, you know, I can't. This was such a contentious topic within the office. I mean, we knew that we needed to get the original Gundam out there. This was, you know, the reasoning at the time was this is the basis for all Gundam. This is a reason why Gundam is an iconic franchise in Japan. But at the end of the day, it was 2001, and Gundam was just very dated. You know, we had just gone from something that had great animation at the time with Gundam Wing to something that was, you know, 10 years younger, 14 years younger, whatever it was. You know, with the original Gundam series, and that really didn't help. I think we lost a lot of fans with the original Gundam.
Do you think that was a pivotal point? It sounds like maybe you thought that is sort of a turning point where it's like, okay, either we're going to effectively build on the momentum of Gundam Wing, or we're going to say no, we have to show them this 30-year-old cartoon because otherwise they're not really going to get it. And then it got moved to like 5 a.m. death slot on Cartoon Network after a very short period of time. Do you think that's where it's like, okay, maybe this isn't going to take off here because we didn't build on this momentum?
I have to agree. You know, I think if we chose anything else other than that, including G Gundam, you know, it would have helped kind of bolster, you know, that brand here. You know, even further. But, you know, the command up on high was we needed to really get that original series out there. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I think everything suffered because of it. You know, ratings were down. The toy products, you know, just weren't taking off anymore. And we just lost a lot of steam.
I heard a rumor that Tomino himself came to LA to supervise the dub. Is that true?
He might have. I don't remember that. I mean, the only time I remember Tomino actually coming out was for the Big Apple Anime Festival out in New York.
I remember that.
That was an interesting time. I think I was watching news clips, and they credited Tomino with as the creator of Astro Boy, and I thought that was pretty funny.
Brilliant. We had a tough time getting the media to really understand what they were reporting there. But we got a lot of press, so hey. Are there any moments that stand out for you particularly that you're like, holy crap, this is what, you know, this is what I really hang my hat on during my time at Bandai?
You know what, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, just the fact that Bandai's been able to adjust and change, you know, within this kind of crazy and turbulent, you know, marketplace, you know, for the last, you know, really, 12 years, that transition from, VHS to DVD, from DVD to Blu-ray, you know, broadcast, bringing in new fans and at the same time, though, again, keeping in mind what the fans, you know, who are the bread and butter, keeping them in mind, you know, throughout this whole process, and really kind of seeing Bandai weather the storm when it came to digital, and what we're seeing with, you know, before it was kind of fan subs and VHS tapes, later on it was kind of bootleg DVDs from China, and then suddenly, you know, the Crunchyrolls of the world that were, you know, broadcasting, you know, fan subs, streaming, and then, you know, lo and behold, now they're a legit outfit, trying to monetize, monetize it on there. And it's just kind of a funny industry, and just seeing Bandai kind of, you know, change and adjust throughout this entire time period, you know, I think is a testament to the people that work there, and their commitment to the genre.
Were there any shows that you recall as being like ones that you were particularly behind that just didn't take off?
Dice, you know, Dice is one of them.
Dice. Which one is that?
Dice was it was an original, I'll just describe it as our animated Power Rangers. I believe it was animated out of Zebek, in Japan. And, it was kind of our original, kids show that we were working in conjunction with, Bandai America, on the toy line. And, you know, Dice was just a, you know, it was kind of our original programming, from BEI that, you know, for whatever reason, just didn't take off. Then there were other things like Zentrix, and trying to think of other crazy ones that didn't really take off.
Zentrix. Monkey Magic.
No, I have fond memories of Monkey Magic. That was really one of the first titles that, you know, that I even, you know, was associated with.
And that sold? You
know, did it sell? No, it didn't sell.
Oh.
But it certainly wasn't the worst title we did.
And what was during the years you were there? During the years you were there,
you know what? Yeah. I don't really remember, but I'll take a guess and I'll say it was Zentrix.
Zentrix. Okay. Yeah, we got some questions about Zentrix, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't remember a lot of people buying it.
People
so
have
I don't
long
know
memories.
Who's asking those questions?
Was Dando after your time?
No. I was part of Dando as well.
Okay.
Well, we'll get to Dando.
Dando the Super Shot, I think, was the title.
We'll get to that, but I did want to ask about Dot Hack, because that was a huge thing for you guys, for Bandai while you were there. And I'm curious, I know it launched strong, but it seemed to lose so much steam over the years, to the point where when you finally got to, like, I think it was the second animated adaptation of Dot Hack, it was airing at the 3:30 a.m. death slot, along with Gundam and whatever other Bandai shows Cartoon Network had picked up, or Adult Swim had picked up. Was that just what were the diminishing returns on that franchise like for you? Is it kind of a roller coaster? I mean, I know there were high expectations on that thing.
Was it a roller coaster? I can't say it was a roller coaster. It started off extremely strong, and I gotta say, it was, you know, the buzzword in the news these days is transmedia properties. And, you know, really, Dot Hack was the poster child for what transmedia would become. You had the animation series, you had the, I think it was a PlayStation 2 game at the time, a series of games. Mm-hmm. You had the manga, you had the music, you had all of these different, you know, components that were all launching, you know, right around the same time. And it was something that, you know, within North America, we hadn't seen before. So, you know, I think a lot of the excitement was driven by that animated content, launching alongside the video game content. As far as, you know, broadcast is concerned, you know, it was strong for the first series. And I think what just ended up happening, the second series just had a totally different, tone. It felt a lot younger.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of that had to do with, you know, waning interests. But you know, if you look at Dot Hack in general, you can't really say that it was the most action packed, you know, series out there. But it was a fun show. And if you were able to experience, you know, each component of that, you know, I think, you know, you really became a fan of the whole thing.
And whose idea was it to send out the giant ridiculous press boxes that you guys used to do?
Ah, that was me.
That was you. Okay, great. Yes. So I got to ask about that. Like, what? I mean, I know that was sort of back in the day when everyone had money and let's woo the press. But those are sort of infamous for their, like, look at what these people wasted money on, like the Dot Hack hexagon with the plush grunty. Which everyone, you know, all of us old school guys sort of look back at that and kind of laugh at it a little bit. Not that we didn't appreciate it, but it was just like, really?
Well, I mean, and at the time, you know, I think within the entertainment business in general, you get a lot of, you know, press packs and press kits with a lot of swag. And, you know, certainly if you worked in the video game industry, I mean, some of the stuff that they pull out, yeah. You know, is pretty amazing. You know, we try to do our part, you know, with the dot hack and really get the bells and whistles in there and get people excited, whether it was the press. Cause I think if I recall, that press kit also doubled as the retailer kit that we would send to buyers, retail buyers. So that really trying to get people excited. Sorry, you were saying?
So that I can understand. the buyers, yeah.
and if I recall, it was the Grunty that we had put in the limited edition was kind of a blue and purple. Was it kind of a bluish purple Grunty? And I think at the time we actually came up with a sample. Charles McCarter was the producer on that, and he had created a white Grunty, which he had given to me. And I think I have the only white Grunty in existence, which is now staring at me in front of my laptop. So I was able to salvage something. That dot hack Grunty was pretty awesome.
Well, and down that line of questioning, do you have a peeing Kiba? The infamous peeing Kiba?
You know what? I think I have a few of those. They're in a box, though, so I haven't seen in a while.
You guys have a long history of plush. So, like, was that all you with the plush dolls? Because Bandai did actually release a lot of those.
No. I mean, I think a lot of this was a joint effort. You know, Charles and some of the other producers, you know, worked you know, pretty hard with our third party vendors to create a lot of these plush products. As well as with Japan, you know, on the approval side. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of a team effort, but it was, you know, that was the other thing. Again, we wanted to bring a lot of that Japanese, you know, collector's edition mentality to North America. And, you know, fans, you know, really enjoyed it when they got, you know, kind of these bonus items and got these cool things that you really just can't buy, you know, outside of whatever that collector's edition or limited edition was. And we just wanted to make sure that things like the plushes, you know, were cool enough that people would, you know, plunk down $49, $59 for this box and a plushie and whatever else was inside, and, you know, four or five episodes.
The downside of that being when you miscalculate and I wind up with a box full of infinite Rivius plush weasels that I'm literally throwing into an audience at an anime expo.
I think I've given away many, many of those weasels, you know, in my career. So we had quite a few. We did overproduce.
Well, when did it? Was there ever a point in the company when? I mean, you were there till you said 2005, but obviously your relationship with that company, you're not there anymore. But it's continued a little bit. At any point in your career, was the idea, oh, this is not as big as we thought it was going to be. Let's start downsizing. Let's start contracting. Let's start doing more limited print runs. I mean, did that ever occur when you were there?
I mean, we always looked at it as growing the market. Again, with broadcasts and everything else, it was always about, you know, how do we you know, and let me preface that by saying, you know, for certain titles, obviously we were doing a lot of, you know, more fan oriented titles that weren't going to move the needle as much. But you know, the fans, you know, were clamoring, there was an audience for it, and the clams and the fans really wanted it. So we would produce those smaller runs. But you know, the idea and our mentality was really to grow the market and to, sell as many units as possible. As far as, you know, contraction and everything else, you know, I think at the time, a lot of that had to do with titles and making sure that we had, you know, really the best titles that, you know, people wanted to see. And, you know, luckily for us, you know, we were going out and getting a lot of those. So, you know, from our side and from my perspective, I mean, you know, there really wasn't any thought of contraction. I mean, it's just something that's kind of happened over time, but, you know, we don't really worry about that.
Is there any particular incident that stands out to you as the one that the fan, you really ate it with the fans on?
Really ate it? What, you mean, like, as far as wrong, like, or?
Well, as far as, like, fans
piss people
just
off?
Exactly.
When did we piss people off? I mean, it always seems like you can't appease anyone in this business. I mean, there's always going to be that one guy that's upset at whatever you did. I certainly got that at different shows and conventions that I attended. There was always that one guy that just, no matter, you know, what answer you gave, just, you know, they had it out for you. But I guess part of it, you know, had to do with Z Gundam. You know, it was one of those titles that we knew was extremely, extremely popular. And, you know, just for a long time, we couldn't get any traction to bring that out. And I just got a lot of flack for that from that Gundam community, because at the end of the day, it seemed as though everyone just wanted to pick up Zeta Gundam, and we just weren't providing it to them.
What happened with that anyway? Because that had kind of a botched release, didn't it? The subtitles were dub titles or something like that.
I don't remember. So that could certainly have happened, but I don't remember.
Was now you got out right before shit started hitting the fan. Were you seeing warning signs and were like, hey, I should do something. I need to look out for number one here, or were you just lucky?
Neither. I think at the time I was looking to go back to school, and I did that. And I was also looking to move over to the East Coast. You know, my girlfriend was actually from New York, now my wife, and I wanted to be closer to her. So, you know, I took a position over at Hasbro in order to do that. I mean, warning signs. There was always warning signs as far as the business. I mean, we had gone from, you know, Suncoast as being that really go-to retailer. And then having all the issues with Musicland at that time, and then being absorbed by Best Buy, you know, we saw a lot of that distribution, you know, really collapsing upon itself. You know, Best Buy wasn't taking products in the full stores. They were only taken within, you know, let's say 500 to 800 stores, their A stores. And so we had a tough time. You know, getting as much of our products into mass as possible, and even then, dealing with mass was kind of a crapshoot. You know, I recall, I think it was ADV had released Tekken, the Tekken movie, animated movie, into Walmart, and you know, I think as the story goes, they shipped in. Let's say I'm just going to throw this number out. I have no idea what it is. Let's say they threw in, you know, 100,000 units in the Walmart. And they probably got 99,000 back. You know, it was kind of, so, you know, you really had to make sure that, that the title was going to sell through, and that was kind of the game everyone was playing. But then, you know, you also want to have product out there.
Yeah. Walmart was particularly known for over ordering and then returning everything. Weren't they? I remember a similar story at CPM.
They were, but at the end of the day, I mean, you know, I think the onus is on the sales reps at the time. You know, their whole job is to get products in the stores. You know, that's what their salary is based on, and they certainly did that. Whether it was the right thing to do, I mean, you know, the market is where it's at now, so it's kind of tough to say.
So I want to get back to Gundam a little bit here. You were talking.
Why does everyone want to talk about Gundam? So just to set the record straight, I was never a fan of Gundam. Okay. You know, Gundam was always, it's always the same storyline. You know, I don't know what it is. It's a kind of a whiny boy doing his thing, finds a Gundam, finds a giant robot suit, jumps in the robot suit, and saves the world. I get that, and to do it from every show to every show to every show, really. You know, I think the only Gundam series that I can say I thoroughly enjoyed was War in the Pocket.
Oh, and, my favorite.
I mean, it was just kind of a, you know, it wasn't that same old rehash, you know, storyline. And it had emotion, it had action, it had all of it. And so if you want to talk about Gundam, we can talk about Gundam.
Well, maybe I shouldn't now. I
feel no, please.
You make me feel
like
an asshole.
I'm sure your audience would rather hear me rant more about Gundam as well. Or not. Well, I might get some threats later.
I want. You know what? I'm sure the two guys that really give a shit about Gundam. I don't think
it's two guys. I think that's a lot more than
you're
that.
Right. It's probably like 15 guys. the big question I had here is so Gundam original TV fails like any sane person would think it would fail. And then there's a whole bunch of course correction. It's like, what do we do? How do we do this? How do we take care of this franchise? I mean, was that just sort of it seemed kind of whiplashy. It's like, well, let's put a bunch of attention on Gundam F91. Then let's push Gundam Seed really hard. And then let's also put out Gundam Zeta and Gundam Double Zeta.
Don't forget G-Savior.
And G-Savior. And it's just like, it seems like, was it just sort of this comical thing where people were just sort of tripping over banana peels and like no one knows how to launch this thing in America?
I mean, that's I think a loaded question, but I'll answer to the best of my ability.
That's what it seems like. I'm not a Gundam fan either, but that's kind of what it seems like.
No, and you know, I mean, I think your observation is spot on, except that there was a strategy in place, and it certainly wasn't what was, you know, actually executed. And at the end of the day, the decision, you know, really was dictated by the licensor, in Japan, and it was Sunrise. So, you know, what we had to do was really do our best to work with Sunrise in kind of mitigating and navigating where the brand was heading and the programming. I think a lot of it had to do with G Gundam being on air. We certainly recognized that we needed to continue to have Gundam in broadcast and keep it kind of in the forefront of Japanese animation on television. But I think where we kind of righted the ship, I guess, really came with Gundam Seed. But I think by the time Gundam Seed really got out there, it kind of missed the mark because of everything else that had happened prior to that.
All right. At any point after Gundam 79 being on TV, did you personally feel like they were making the right move with this franchise? Just as an observer, like as someone, even if you were a peon, as you said, in the company at the time, looking at that franchise, did you ever think, oh, this is a good move?
I think the release of a lot of the shows on DVD, getting a lot of the leading up to Gundam Seed, I think that's when we really kind of got our act together from that standpoint. But again, so much of your success, especially at BEI, hinged upon broadcast, Gundam Seed just kind of did what it did, but didn't even come close to what Gundam Wing had done previously.
Yeah, well, and the weird thing is that those are two completely different audiences. Like Gundam Wing served, it was for a completely different audience than Gundam Seed.
Well, and I think part of it is also, the content. I I'm half joking, during my earlier rant about, my love-hate for Gundam.
I only heard hate.
Yeah, Gundam Seed, I did enjoy. And part of the reason why I enjoyed Gundam Seed was that it wasn't necessarily, a rehash of everything else. Tamino, if I recall, Tamino didn't really have a hand at any point within the kind of that storyline, although I'm sure, a lot of people took inspiration and talked to him about it. But, my understanding was that the director at the time, really wanted to do something kind of new and groundbreaking for the series. And I think Gundam Seed was just so refreshing, compared to kind of that Universal Century. Whether old school UC folks enjoyed that, I mean, I've heard, kind of mixed reactions, but I know personally, I did.
Right. And then did you ever sit through Gundam Seed Destiny?
I have not actually seen Gundam Seed Destiny, no. So maybe well,
according to everyone, you're in a better place for it.
Okay.
I've never heard a more widely hated show.
But I mean, going back to your early question, I mean, as far as things like Char's Counterattack and F91, A lot of that had to do with the way releases, were at the time, and really, individual DVD volumes, for an episodic TV series, whether it's 13 or 26 episodes, were very, very difficult. And we were looking at a lot of content that were more standalone and more almost theatrical. And, certainly F91 was a theatrical movie we wanted to bring out. So I think that's where a lot of the emphasis, lied when we brought that out. I think a lot of it was a bit dated also as far as the animation style. I know we tried to do a few things to kind of, mitigate that. I think, Tsukasa Kotobuki, who was the character designer for Saber Marionette J, he was actually he's a big fan of Gundam, and a friend of mine, and I reached out to Sunrise to see if we could get a new theatrical poster created, recommended Mr. Kotobuki to do it because he had always wanted to work on Gundam, and he came out with a really kick-ass poster. I don't know if anyone still has it, but we really wanted to revamp that look. And we did it with some of the, I can't recall if we used it in the packaging or not. But those were the types of things that we were doing at the time, really bringing out a lot of theatrical stuff. And I wish we did more of that at Bandai during that time period. I mean, between, the F91, the Escaflowne movie, Jinro, we came out with a lot of really cool movies. And
how did Jinro do anyway? I was always curious.
Jinro did all right. Didn't blow. It wasn't a Studio Ghibli, theatrical release. But if I recall, it did at least a couple hundred thousand.
Box office or
unit sales. Box office was I don't want to say it was abysmal, but it was kind of laughable. Theatrical is really hard, but for Escaflowne, we had handled the theatrical release, in house, and we kind of biked that around. But we got it into places that people actually were watching movies, in kind of major markets, and not just art houses. Jinro was being, and I don't know if a lot of people remember, but we were actually working with Viz. On Jinro. It was kind of a co-finance deal. I don't remember the specifics, but a subsidiary at Viz handled theatrical kind of theatrical films. I forget the name of it. It was like Tide Point or something, and they actually handled the theatrical run while we handled the home video. And so I never really got to see it, in theaters. It never played where I was. So that was kind of a bit of a disappointment, but from a home video standpoint, it did pretty good, and certainly one of the more I think underappreciated anime films that are out there.
Were you there for the dawning? And I know you guys were initially completely unrelated. The dawning of Bandai Visual USA.
No, I was there. I was there. It was interesting. That it was kind of forming, I think a lot of the reasoning for that. I mean, I have no clue. I can only kind of guess at. But I'll just assume that Bandai Visual wanted to see if there was a better model that they could place to North American audiences that kind of mirrored closely to what was happening in Japan, whether it's for bigger margins on DVD sales or better quality or whatever it is that they felt, but they tried, and I guess it didn't work out.
Were you had when they were rolling out their release plans, you had to have been sitting back in your chair and kind of gave a nervous chuckle going, oh my god, they can't possibly be serious.
I can't speak for everyone in the office. I think that everyone wanted to see them at least, succeed. They were still a group company. But I think a few of our...
I don't believe that for a second.
No, a few of our more vocal, members of the department, certainly voiced their criticism and whatnot. You know, from my side, I was just disappointed, you know, because I think at the time, Diebuster, you know, was being released. And, you know, this was a great opportunity to bring back Gunbuster. And Gunbuster was my favorite show. I mean, that was really, you know, one of the first true anime shows that I got into, you know, the U.S. renditions release. And, you know, I thought, wow, this is an opportunity to bring a classic that no one's seen, you know, a long time onto DVD. But unfortunately, you know, Bandai Visual ended up releasing it on their end. A little pricey, but I did pick it up.
As did we all.
That must, I mean, to be blunt, I mean, that must be a little frustrating because you're looking at this other business idea, and this is a completely different business model that they're working on at this point, which is why I assume it was kept separate from you at Bandai Entertainment. They're working on a model where we can price this stuff into the stratosphere, and we're going to work on a Japanese business model, you know, where we expect people to pay premium prices for shit from the 80s or whatever. That must be frustrating to sit there and be like, no, but we could totally sell that. That must have been frustrating.
I don't think it was ever that contentious. It was just that, you know, as fans within BEI, you know, we certainly liked what we liked, and Gunbuster was one of the key ones that we wanted to bring out there. But, you know, as far as all the bells and whistles and that more premium, you know, pricing model, you know, I gotta say, I mean, their product were great. It was they were great products.
Oh, sure. And, yeah, absolutely.
And it was beautiful. You know, I'm one of the ones that bought it, but, you know, for the other, you know, tens of thousands of anime fans out there, you know, would they have paid, you know, $60, $70 for, you know, a two disc set? I have no idea. I doubt it. You know, but I'm just speaking from my own kind of personal perspective. You know, I wish we could have been able to kind of put that out there. I think we would have been able to achieve that same quality bar and bells and whistles, which we demonstrated in the past. At the same time, you know, we work on something that, you know, we personally had a cool connection with.
You're such a low key guy. I can't imagine you getting like really bent out of shape, frustrated by much.
No, I mean, there were a lot of heated exchange. I mean, I can't say everything was, you know, roses and at Bandai. You know, I think you just get a lot of passionate. That was the one thing we had plenty of. We had a lot of passion, you know, from everyone that's ever worked there. And so, like any family, you'll have your squabbles, and people will get, you know, get heated, and, you know, I get heated as well.
Okay, well that's very interesting, because I always kind of suspected, you know, the whole Oniyami's initiative must have caused some kind of a rift, where at least you were thinking in the back of your head, like, man, we could totally have handled that release. Like, that would have been cool. Like, if we'd have been able to handle that release, we totally could have done it. And we wouldn't have made it $80 or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, again, though, I mean, it was an attempt by Bandai Visual, and from our side, you know, at the time, we didn't necessarily have that direct relationship with them. They were almost treated as a completely separate company. The only one that really had that kind of communication was Mystery Yodomi. So, you know, I think from again, it was just more from our side as fans of anime more than anything else. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think I left, and I think we absorbed Bandai Visual. I think a lot of those folks, you know, moved over to BEI. So,
well, it doesn't exist anymore, and BEI does, so.
Yeah, we took them over.
As for the BEI releases, are there any that you felt could have been handled better, you wish you could maybe have done over, or you're just like, eh?
There were a lot of titles I wish we didn't do.
Well.
You know, I mean, there were a lot of titles that, you know, I think a lot, there was just, whether it was for relationships or whatever it was, you know, I don't know, but there were a few that it was just a big question mark as far as, you know, why we were releasing these.
Because of Yonichimbo.
I can't say the units there aren't the worst. Again, those aren't the worst ones.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe that's not a more, you know, appropriate one. I mean, I'll look at Zentrix as one of those titles where there was, I just can't think of a reason why we were doing that. I mean, that was, I think that was Imagi's first original animated anything at the time. And it just looked strange and didn't fit what we were doing. It wasn't really anime. It might have been co-financed by Bandai Visual at some point. But it made no sense to me at all, and just kind of conflicted with everything else we had going on. So, I mean, that was one. You know, the other one, I think, you know, that really came to mind was it was a show called Taruto. It was like Magical Meow Meow Taruto, and wow. I didn't get that one at all. And Overman King Gainer. I watched that opening TV, just the opening where they did that little dance, and I just thought this is so goofy. There's a few that there were a lot of gems that came out of this, you know, that I never expected to do well. And they did pretty good. But then there were a lot that didn't as well.
Any shockers that you were expecting to just completely fall on their face, and then against all odds, they just blew up?
Against all odds, just blew up. Crest of the Stars.
Really?
You know, this is just for my own opinion, but you know, Crest of the Stars, it's not an action show. It's a very cerebral show. You know, it's all about the storyline. And you know, I just looked at it and I watched it and I just thought, wow, it's putting me to bed. And you know, it did very well. I don't know if the subsequent series did as well as the first one, but I know the first one did well.
I always wondered if that was just like a small but fervent nerd community, or if that actually did numbers.
No, it's certainly what you described. It was a small fervent nerd community, but they were very adamant and passionate about it, and it was very consistent.
Were you there for the demise of the single release?
It was kind of happening, you know, around my time. You know, I think the model that we had adopted for, let's say, a 13 episode series was kind of four volumes at, you know, 4-4-3-3 or 4-3-3-3, and then for a six volume for a 26 episode series, and then kind of a collection at the end. And you know, within the models, I mean, that really seemed to work. You know, I think that move to a more collected volume, you know, that started happening, I think right around when I was leaving. And it's hard for me to kind of understand from a business perspective, you know, how that was better. I think that's more for some of the other companies out there. I think for us, a lot of the titles had already amortized, and we were just kind of releasing these as collections, anime legends, and so on. So it kind of made sense. But for a lot of these other companies that were releasing brand new shows as collection, it boggled my mind. Were they looking to sell additional volume in order to kind of meet that break even point? And I couldn't see a lot of these titles doing that, you know, as a collection.
All right. That's kind of all I had. Zach, did you have anything before we got to Twitter?
Well, yeah, we got to talk about Dando. So this is sort of a running joke. Dando is widely considered to be the most ill-considered license of the last 10 years, among other things. But it's a sports anime about golf. It feels like you couldn't really get less marketable than that to the audience that you're selling DVDs to. It's like, most people look at it as like, why the fuck would anyone even consider this for release in the U.S.? And you were there during that, so why?
Well, before we talk about Dando, you know, I have to say, you know, around that time period, you know, I think sports anime is, you either love it or you hate it. And there were really few sports anime that really made a difference. You know, Princess Nine was a kind of a baseball show. I enjoyed it. Didn't move the needle at all. I doubt ADV sold a ton of units on that. Slam Dunk was another series I wish we were able to pick up. But it was super influential, you know, at least to me. I loved it.
And so you got Dear Boys.
And so I made the push for Dear Boys, you know, to Mr. Yodomi. And you know, this was really based off of, I think, the first few episodes that I had seen, you know, out of Japan. And, you know, I should have known better. You know, the animation quality that dropped from episode 3 to 4 was so notable. The ball didn't even spin after a few episodes. It just kind of floated in the air into the basket. So, you know, I take full responsibility for, you know, for us bringing Dear Boys over. The manga is great. I recommend everyone to read the manga. I thought the title, you know, was a bit ill-conceived. We did that in a group setting, and I just thought that was the wrong thing to do. People kind of threw out different titles that would be more accessible than Dear Boys. Dear Boys didn't really scream, you know, basketball. But, you know, I look at a title like Hoop Days, and, you know, I just cringe every time I hear it now. But that was done in kind of a committee form. And, you know, I don't think we ever did that again. Now going back to the original question, Dando, ill-conceived, you know, at the end of the day, Mr. Yodomi loves golf. He's an avid golfer, and he loves golf. And it shouldn't be surprised to anyone that he loves golf anime. And so, lo and behold, we have Dando the Super Shot.
Well, I think that answers that question.
I wish it was as like there's some huge storyline. A licensor wouldn't give us the rights to the next Cowboy Bebop unless we brought Dando as well. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Ken really likes golf, and there was a golf anime out there, and next thing you know, we had Dando.
They had you at gunpoint. You had to do it.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't think it would be that simple, but I guess it is. Yep. Was there any contention or any like, man, I wish we could have been able to handle that with the Cowboy Bebop movie, because I know Sony put that out themselves.
Yep.
And y'all didn't get a crack at it, or I mean, obviously you sort of would have wanted that.
I think a part of it has to do with the way a lot of these films are financed, and yeah. Sony was part of the committee that financed the film, so they kind of had an in on that. You know, but at the end of the day, I mean, we work closely with Sony on kind of co-promoting as much as possible. So, I mean, that's fine.
I did want to ask, how do you feel about the anime industry right now? Do you feel like anyone's doing it right? I'd love your take on the way things are going now, you know, as an outside observer.
This could be the most contentious part of the conversation. Okay. You know, do I think anyone's doing it right? You know, honestly, you know, I modeled a lot of what I was doing, you know, with Pioneer / Genion. You know, a lot of people probably don't remember this, but, you know, early on when we were transitioning from Anime Village to kind of the brick and mortar, Pioneer was actually our distributor to retail. And so I had an opportunity to kind of mentor under Chad Keim over there. And, you know, it was a lot of what they did over there, you know, is how we went about, you know, our business at BEI. We did it. I mean, there were a lot of differences. We certainly did things our way, and we kind of, you know, took our marching orders from Ken, and he has certainly a different way of approaching things. But, you know, I think, you know, model a lot of that based on what they did, and compared that to kind of what's going on in the industry right now. I mean, you know, you see nothing but contraction. You see, you know, a lot of companies just kind of going away. A lot of the old companies in the past, you know, the CPMs of the world, you know, aren't Genion are no longer with us. You have kind of Media Blasters. You know, I don't remember the last time they actually released anime. They do a lot of, you know, kind of horror and Japanese, you know, content and films. But as far as anime, you know, it's few and far between. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way the market is and the way consumers and the fans, you know, consume Japanese animation now. You know, before it was kind of packaged goods. you know, while we did have the internet, it wasn't as though you can go on, you know, as many streaming sites as you could now to kind of watch your fan subs. And, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but then you had guys like, you know, Crunchyroll that were basically, you know, taking fan subs and kind of streaming it on their own. And lo and behold, they're trying to be a legitimate company now. It's just kind of funny how the industry is these days. But I think it's a tough period. Everything is going digital right now, and it's hard to monetize everything. Your anime isn't getting that same shelf space anymore at retail. Retailers themselves are contracting. Borders is no longer, you know, with us. You know, so on and so forth. So that how do you monetize it has been, you know, extremely, extremely difficult. And that's not to say digital's necessarily the way either. Last I checked, Crunchyroll doesn't have hundreds and thousands of subscribers, paying subscribers. I don't know how they keep the light on over there, but you know, maybe their angel investors just continue to keep pumping money into them, hoping that they'll do something. But you know, it's a tough time period right now, and you know, I think you see a lot of that coming out of Japan too. You know, they're struggling to keep that whole industry afloat as well. And you know, it's tough. And you know, I wish the best of luck to a lot of these companies that are still out there.
Okay.
That was
sorry,
happy.
That was a bit long-winded and certainly not very positive. But I, you know, I haven't seen anything cool come out recently either. I mean, you know, I think the last anime I watched was Summer Wars, and just from a content, I thought that was fantastic. But even Funimation, they have so many titles, and they're, you know, I think they absorbed the Genion catalog, they absorbed the Tokyo Pop catalog, so on and so forth. I mean, that's a lot of product out there.
Well, a lot of it's expired now.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, from one fan to another, when it comes out, Jerry, you specifically, I think you'll enjoy Redline.
Redline. It sounds like porn.
It's the kind of thing that I think old school anime fans like. Also, it's about racing, so you'll probably dig that.
Okay. I'll check into it.
Basically, Madhouse spent 10 years on it.
Madhouse spent 10 years making a racing movie.
Yeah, no, at one point, I think it was back in 1999, I was lobbying so hard for Initial D. You know, and at that time, you know, Ken seemed pretty adamant not to, you know, I should say he wasn't willing to work with Kodansha, but you know, he was just so focused on what we were doing with Sunrise and Bandai Visual. But I kept pushing and pushing for Initial D, and finally they got around to talking to Kodansha, and I think we were talking right around the same time that Tokyo Pop was looking into it, and one of the main things that they needed to have happened in order for us to do the TV series was to have a kind of a manga division, and to bring the manga out. And we just didn't have that business component. And, that's one of my biggest regrets at Bandai that we weren't able to do that.
Did you ever actually see the Tokyo Pop version of it?
Yeah, I think, for a long time I had, Stu, I think Stu actually rewrote the opening theme song, and I had it on play on my computer, listening over and over again. It was great.
Would you stare into the middle distance and sort of swirl your whiskey as that happened?
I mean, I knew where Stu was going with that. And you know, it wasn't very good. I mean, but, yeah, no, I wish we were able to do Initial D. I think that was one of those crossover titles, you know, to the mainstream that could have done very well. And to be honest, I'm surprised that he wasn't able to get it onto TV and really expose that to a new audience. I know within the car community, Initial D is, you know, everyone knows about it.
Well, that's a shame. I know Funimation re-released it and it did well for them. So
good.
Could have been a contender.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get to Twitter because we got a lot of those questions. Kiri Elson asks, Why do you think the singles format continued to linger around for so long?
I think partially because that was the only way to make money, you know, and break even from a lot of these smaller titles. You know, the collections, in order for a collections to work, you really had to sell, you know, kind of volumes above and beyond what you would on an individual volume basis. And more often than not, the folks that really wanted a series, you know, they're going to pick it up, you know, for those kind of smaller profile shows. And, you know, you really had to be able to monetize it across multiple volumes in order to kind of get the maximum return on that investment. And yeah, and even then, it was so difficult to break even for kind of those smaller shows that didn't have, you know, exposure or a huge fan base already.
Right. And, you know, Bandai is one of the only companies that's still doing that.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, they've been in the black. If I recall, you know, I think last year they were in the black. They weren't losing money. They were making money. And I think that was good.
Towards the end of your run there, were you noticing the same pattern where Genion was just, you know, a whole bunch of their shows just were not even coming close to breaking even?
Yeah, I mean, you know, aside from, you know, an occasional Samurai Champloo and a Trigun, I mean, there were a lot of shows on there that, you know, I think from a fan perspective were fantastic. But for the amount of money that you spend in dubbing a show and doing all of that, I just didn't see that return, you know, coming. I think more often than not, by the time I left, we were taking a kind of a hard look at TV shows and really kind of evaluating, hey, is this show worth dubbing? Because, you know, at the end of the day, you dub a show because you wanted to make it as accessible as possible to a wide audience. And, you know, if it was a really fan oriented show that, you know, like a Taruto, did it deserve, you know, or warrant a dub release? You know, looking back, probably not.
All right. Speaking of which, Exodore US asks, how badly did Cyber Formula bomb?
Cyber Formula. I don't remember. And, I think it bombed pretty well. I think it happened for a number of reasons. You know, one, it wasn't like it was a super in-demand show. I mean, it was certainly popular in Asia, outside of Japan. I think our release pattern was a little off. I think we released it under either one kind of box set or two split box sets. I can't remember. But if we were going to do that, I'll be honest, we didn't put enough marketing effort behind that to really drive the interest in getting someone to pay, you know, $50 to $80 on a show they've probably never seen. You know, it was pretty tough, but that was a big bomb.
All right.
Not as big of a bomb as Centrix, but I could be wrong.
You know, while Zach is going through these Twitter questions, I'm just going through the Bandai Entertainment database on the encyclopedia, and I caught one that I'm like, oh crap, I have to ask about this. Junkers Come Here.
That please was a great one.
I love that movie, but please explain that cover. What happened?
The cover itself? I'm trying to think. The cover
was just a big, giant, oversized Junkers the dog. Pasted on top of a faded background, way too big, and a word balloon kind of pedantically telling you how to pronounce Junkers.
I don't recall, you know, why that was chosen. I would assume it's because, you know, that movie was so much about just kind of family relationships that it's hard to get a really exciting cover, and Junkers is really the star of that show. But you know, it's a great film. I don't remember why that cover was the way it was, though.
Oh, sorry. Disappointment.
That's okay.
But to all your listeners, I mean, that's certainly a hidden gem. And if it's still available, you know, I certainly encourage, people to check it out.
You could find that at Big Lots for the longest time, which always made me sad.
Okay. Also from Exodore US, I think we know the answer to this, but do you still have your AE-86?
I sold my AE-86 when I left for the East Coast back in 05. But since then, I've picked up, I think, 7 different 86s, and I currently have 2.
So, no.
Well, I don't have the original one, no. But I do have 2 more, and one of them is a right-hand drive. And I've been toying around with the idea of converting that to a Takumi mobile.
Okay. The dream lives on.
It does.
It's good to know. You know what? That's heartwarming, in a sense. All right. And finally, Exeter US asks, what lesson would you tell people to take away from the boom and bust of the anime industry? But I mean, you left Bandai before the bust happened. But as an observer, I mean, what lesson would you say people should take from that?
Well, I mean, as a fan, I mean, here's support the companies as much as possible. I mean, it's not the companies that you're supporting. It's also the industry as a whole. It's the animators. You know, they're the ones creating this content. If there's not a market for it, if they can't monetize against it, there just won't be any content. And that sounds, you know, a bit preachy, you know, but at the end of the day, I think, you know, the market has changed the way consumers and fans, you know, watch anime. It's so much different now. They can, you know, go on any streaming site and be able to watch fan subs, but support your company as much as possible. You know, because at the end of the day, you know, if these studios aren't making money, you're just not going to see any more coming out.
Itoju asks, given that Bandai is no stranger to pitching hi-fi video releases, why have they been so conservative releasing Blu-rays in the U.S.? I'm not sure if you can answer that, but there you go.
Yeah, I left right before. I mean, Blu-ray as a format was just coming out, and I remember a lot of different discussions on how we would approach Blu-ray. You know, I'll just assume that it was a bit cost prohibitive, or the licensor, you know, just wasn't having it. So one of the two. I mean, from a price point perspective, I guess you would, Blu-rays would have to be around $34 to $40 in order to make it worthwhile, even now. And I think a lot of it has to do with the industry as a whole. I mean, that the whole home video market from DVD and so on has just gotten so soft. You know, during that transition to Blu-ray, it's just so tough. You know, even for mass market, you know, entertainment packaged goods. You know, it's even tougher for kind of niche genres like Japanese animation.
All right. GR Niminich asks, was Sunrise more hands-on with Gundam 79 compared to other Gundam series, and did they have any strange requests or demands for it?
I think we covered a bit of that.
We did.
They were absolutely hands-on. You know, we provided a lot of direction and suggestions. You know, but and I'm not going to say it was, you know, it was all Sunrise. You know, I think a lot of, you know, Sunrise's direction really came from Tamino. So I'll just blame Tamino.
Okay.
Easy target.
That answers another question. If you had any fun Tamino stories.
Maybe not with Tamino. I don't think I've ever met him personally. I've met a lot of creators during my career, from Mr. Kawamori, Mrs. Kono, so on and so forth. But Tamino, I never actually met. I do have this one picture that a coworker had taken in New York of him making this just obscene, weird face. And Justin, maybe I'll email that to you, and you can kind of post that up. But
yes,
I mean, it's just a ridiculous looking face, and I don't know if he was high or what it was. but it was just so strange. But I mean, my only Tamino story, I think, forget which anime expo it was, but they were auctioning off an autographed Tamino Hato, and I was just having fun, and I wanted to donate to a really good charity, and I thought, well, let's pick up this autographed Hato during the charity auction at Expo, and you know, I won the bid, and you know, I took that Tamino autographed packaging, and I ripped it off and threw it in the trash, and I kept the Hato. And it's sitting right in front of me. He was, I don't want to say he was the bane of my existence. But you know, he was a genius for creating Gundam. And you know what? Time to move on.
Oh, he's tried.
Wow. So, okay.
Instead we got Overman King Gainer.
And Garzy's Wing.
Yes. Garzy's wing. He did while he was a bit more younger. So
okay.
Well, that made it better.
Yeah. All right. Well, more Gundam questions. Chard Knight asks, why do you think that Gundam Seed, and he puts in parentheses, the most popular TV series of the last decade in Japan.
Really?
I don't know if that's true. Why do you think that Gundam Seed was not a huge hit in America?
I think we're rehashing kind of what we talked about. I think a lot of it was little too late. We had the original Gundam on that really kind of dampened Gundam in the eyes of a lot of people, and then from there it was just hard to recover from. It's a great series, but I don't, it was the best in the last decade of Japan. I don't know about that. I think that title goes to One Piece.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a different class, I think.
Definitely the longest.
Well, in terms of like most popular TV show in Japan in the last 10 years, I would not say Gundam Seed. Like, that title wouldn't even occur to me. All right. Okay, so Land of Obscusion asks about Hoop Days, specifically about the decision to stop selling singles and just doing a box set. What goes into a decision like that?
Well, I guess a lot of it has to do with whether or not the title is actually selling. If right. The per volume, you know, just isn't there, I mean, got to figure out a way to kind of jumpstart that and at the end of the day, getting a collection out there at a great price point. You know, so we'll certainly do that. But, you know, Hoop Days didn't sell, as individuals. I don't think it necessarily sold as a box set as well.
So it's a fire sale, basically.
A fire sale, you're just kind of trying to get rid of it. I think they were certainly trying to salvage what they could. And again, I apologize to Mr. Iodomi for that. That's my fault.
Okay. Also from Land of Obscusion was, Urguys ever planned for a DVD release?
I don't think so. I think our license for that had expired before we were really bringing most of our titles on a DVD.
Okay, because he says a Steven Blum narrated trailer was on the Eat Man 98 DVDs, but nothing came.
Really?
That's what he says.
I don't disagree with him. It probably was.
I don't know what he's talking about.
I did most of those trailers, so I do remember doing that, but I don't remember if we actually put it on the VHS or the DVD?
He says DVD.
DVD. It might have been on the schedule at one point.
I didn't even know Eat Man 98 came out on DVD. So
yeah, it was only a collection. Came out.
Right.
Only 98, not Eat Man.
Okay.
To my eternal regret.
Nana K fan asked, "Did Flag bomb as hard as I think it did?"
I was there for Flag.
Okay. All right.
I want more Monkey Magic questions.
I'm scrolling through these. Sorry.
And I'm also curious how many people found the Easter egg in Planetus. There was one Easter egg that was thrown in there that was just so full of awesome. And it was, I think the producer of Planetus is Taku. Taku and I had gone down to the Johnson Space Center to actually, put together like kind of a short documentary on space junk. And we went to the Johnson Space Center and they had if you're weightless in space, you can kind of, it simulates that experience. And we had Taku in a video, just kind of floating around, but he hid it in there. But I've never heard if anyone's actually found it. I haven't seen it myself. So
well, I'm going to have to tear apart that disc.
Yeah.
Is it on the disc too? Cause those got removed from the box sets.
You know what? I don't remember, but it was just kind of funny. I don't even remember if we actually showed it to the licensor for approval. I don't know if I should have said that.
Well, it's not like you can get in trouble. It's not like you can get in trouble for it.
Well, now Sunrise will not return Bandai's calls.
Yeah.
Sorry.
JLA King Forever asks, did Bandai ever have plans for a budget line like what Funimation has with Save and Media Blasters has with Light Boxes?
A budget line. Well, I think a lot of the collections that we had done were kind of that budget line. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, $20 for an entire series or something like that, I mean, I don't think there was ever really contemplation to do that. I mean, we were in the business to kind of, you know, obviously, you know, make money. I don't know how you can make money doing a lot of those, $15 for an entire series type of deal. I mean, again, you would have to make that up in volume, and even then, you know, I can't imagine a lot of these shows getting the type of volume that would warrant, you know, something like that.
All right. Kikin 00083 asks, when Bandai Visual went out and all of its assets were transferred to BEI, I'm not sure if that's true or not, but if is it possible BEI still has the rights to Bandai Visual catalog titles like MS Igloo?
No idea. Yeah. I didn't know Bandai Visual USA had a lot of assets. I know most a lot of the employees transferred over to BEI, but whether or not the content itself transferred over, I have no idea.
Okay. All right. Now I got a couple of questions left on email. There's a few left here. Okay. From rhunter195 asks, from your side, do you know anything regarding what happened to the Big O Season 3, which was optioned to be created before Season 2 even aired and then dropped before it could be made? Any chance of that project reemerging?
I don't remember Big O 3. I think there was certainly there was an option for it, but at the end of the day, it did okay. It did okay broadcast. It did okay on DVD, and I think that was a problem. It just did okay.
Right. Yeah. Everyone wanted that to be much bigger than it actually was.
Yeah, and I mean, just kind of remembering some of the sales numbers, I don't believe Big O 2. I think it was significantly lower sales than Big O 1, and it just didn't warrant having another series.
Around the time of My Otome, My Hime, Bandai seemed to be going through huge replicator issues. Single volumes were unplayable, and volumes were getting delayed for months at a time. Can you discuss why this was going on for such a prolonged period? This is from Kimani Barone.
I mean, I don't remember specifically which replicator it was. I know we've always had kind of issues with discs, and I think it's pretty common within the industry as a whole, whether it's kind of loose discs being shipped out into the marketplace or some type of issue. As far as, you know, what the actual issues were with the replicators, I mean, I don't know. We've had issues in the past where we were transitioning from, you know, replicators that Pioneer Genion used to other ones. And so there was kind of a learning curve there. I think it just really, really depends. I don't really have a good answer for you there.
No, that's cool. I got to ask, you know, during your time there, you know, looking back on those years, it sounds like you took a lot of cues from what the other companies were doing, from what the other major players were back then, which would be Genion and ADV. And looking back then, I mean, were there any moments or initiatives or releases that you remember where it just sort of baffled you? Or you didn't really understand, you know, why they were taking that particular route? Because those were weird years. Like, people were spending money on weird shit.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, the only ones I really thought that were doing it, you know, kind of quote-unquote the right way was Pioneer. You know, I have the highest amount of respect for those guys over there. And as I do for all the other companies. But... you know, as far as ADV and I was never really too concerned about kind of, you know, what they were doing and trying to emulate, you know, their way of doing things. I think, you know, we had a strategy in place, you know, whether it was, you know, outreach through conventions or whatever it was. And, you know, we were very fiscally sound when it came to spending money on marketing. We wanted to make sure that we were spending money to reach as many people as possible. As far as, you know, what we saw from other companies, and it was just wild and wacky. You know, I can't really, I mean, you know, speak to any one thing. I will say, you know, I'm surprised that a lot more of the companies didn't place more effort in getting you know, their programs onto broadcast for whatever reason. You know, I think a lot of them certainly tried and attempted to, but that was really the biggest shocker during my entire, you know, career, you know, within this anime world was, you know, TV was such an important part in exposing entire generations to the content. You know, I just felt that all the companies should be doing that in some form or fashion.
You guys were doing something special. I don't know what, but I know that both Genion and ADV had full-time staff just charged with getting stuff on TV.
Sure, Genion actually a pioneer. So during the pioneer, their guy that was handling broadcast rights was actually the Blue Ranger, if what? I recall correctly. He was a Blue Ranger
in Japan or here?
No, here. They were one of the original Power Rangers. The blue one was handling broadcast rights.
Interesting. And weird. Mostly weird.
Well, I mean, and then ADV at one point had also hired Carl Masek, of Robotech fame, to kind of help with the broadcast as well, and then trying to get some shows on. But again, a lot of that just never took off. I think Evangelion had a short run on TV, but it just never. I think it was kind of one and done.
Yeah, I mean, it was clearly never something they were really all that good at doing. Somehow you guys just got really good placement all the time, and I never. I think maybe probably being able to buy toy ads for toys helped.
Yeah, but that was only for Gundam Wing. I mean, certainly there wasn't really. I shouldn't say there wasn't toy lines for Cowboy Bebop. There was a toy line. I don't recall that ever being part of the broadcast rights negotiation, though.
Well, at any rate,
we actually have toys for Outlaw Star too. I wonder if I still have those.
Really?
There was an entire line of anime action figures that one of our counterparts at Bandai America had created.
Outlaw Star, man, all but forgotten these days.
No, you know what? I think the guys over at Bandai keep telling me, you know, out of all the kind of the non-broadcast, it was broadcast too, but you know, the non-Cowboy Bebop, the non-Escaflowne, the non, you know, Ghost in the Shell. The ones that keep selling over and over again, Blue Submarine continues to do well. Outlaw Star continues to do well.
And SD Gundam.
SD Gundam, I don't think so.
I don't really buy Blue Submarine. I guess if they say so, but really?
No. Even when I was there, I mean, Blue Submarine was a very, very consistent seller. It was just, you know, four OVAs, and it was, pretty decent animation, and it holds up even today. So
apparently, I didn't even know they still had it in print.
I don't know if it's still in print now, but yeah.
Well,
I think in aggregate, it should be over 150,000 units. I'm just guessing, but I think it did very well.
Nothing sells 150,000 units today.
Yeah, I mean, Cowboy Bebop, it's got to be in. It was around 100 when I left, so it's got to be around 200 now, I would imagine. At least on a per volume basis.
Oh, per volume. Because I was about to say, wait a minute. Cowboy Bebop as a franchise has only sold, as of 2005, had only sold 100,000 units.
Well, I mean, there's also, no. It sold more than that. And that's not including, you know, I'm not even thinking about, you know, all the remixes that they've done and collections, and that's not including all the old VHS tapes and whatnot. I mean, Cowboy Bebop, really is a phenomenon.
Indeed it is.
And we could use one of those.
Yeah, we need another one of those. That's a problem.
With Keanu Reeves?
Well, listen, that was all very revealing, and thanks for answering all those questions.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Jerry for coming on by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can find him at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a little rating and review, and we'll see you all next week.